Okay, we're on the record.
Okay, I'll call the strategic planning meeting of the Alaska Energy Authority to order. Roll call, please.
Yes, sir. Commissioner Sandy? Mr. Smythe?
Present.
Mr. Myosifin? Okay, can you hear us on the team meeting?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. Mr. Myosifin? Mathiasen? Hey, absent.
Present.
Present. Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Seidman?
Yeah, present.
Mr. Izzo?
Tony Izzo here.
Mr. Mitchell?
I'm present.
Chair Copeland?
Present.
You have a quorum.
Okay, thank you. I actually don't have an agenda in front of me, but turn it over to
you. Hang on. I can set it up.
Okay, entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
I'll make that motion. Don't finish it. Tony Izzo, second.
Have a motion, a second. Any additions or exclusions or modifications to the agenda? Hearing none, a roll call vote, please.
Yes, sir. Mr. Mathiasen?
Yes.
Mr. Seaton?
Yes.
Mr. Smythe?
Yes.
Mr. Izzo?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Mr. Copeland?
Yes.
The motion carries, Chair.
Thank you. Entertain a motion to approve the minutes of the October 30th, 2025 meeting.
This is Kowal, and a motion to approve those minutes.
I'll second. Mathiasen here.
Thank you. We have a motion, a second. Any additions, deletions, or corrections, I guess, to the minutes? Hearing none, roll call vote, please.
Yes. Mr. Smythe?
Yes.
Mr. Mathiasen?
Yes.
Mr. Seidman?
Yes.
Mr. Izzo?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Mr. Copeland?
Yes.
The motion carries, Chair.
Okay, the meeting is now open for public comment for those in the room or online.
Okay, if there's anyone on the Teams meeting that would like to make a public comment, please raise your hand and you'll be recognized. I could see, perhaps. Okay. There does not appear to be any public comment. Is there anybody in the room that would like to make a public comment? Okay. No public comments, Chair.
Okay, seeing none, we have no old business to consider. So next we'll move on to resolution. Can I get the agenda back, please? Move on to consideration of resolution 2026-01, which is the ratification of the fiscal year 27 operating and capital budget submissions.
I move that the board approve resolution 2026-01 ratifying the governor's fiscal year 27 operating and capital budget submissions as presented.
And I'll second that for discussion.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion.
Yeah, I would just like to just have an overview. I mean, I've read it. Is there any commentary from staff on the submission? I'm just asking for protocol to.
No. This is Curtis there.
Traditionally, what AEA has done, or the corporations have done, is after the governor submits his budget to the legislature, then there's a ratification. The board approves the spending levels for that particular agency. And so what I wanted to highlight was in the governor's budget, in the governor's budget, he does have funding for electrical emergencies. Federal tax credit language is already included in the governor's, which allows us federal tax credits to use those for AEA projects. There's also, which we had discussed, $15.3 million in Ocean Ranger funds to be used for cruise ship terminal port electrification, in which they're asking AEA, the governor's office is asking AEA to develop a program in which to electrify docks, and to establish that policy, that procedure of how to do that. Several years ago, we did get money for the Whittier dock, and that one is, we partnered with, Holland America and, Princess, International Electric, and that one is currently underway, and now this is a $15 million and possibly going further, and that is looking at the docks, whether they be Ketchikan, Sitka, Juneau, and elsewhere. So that was the $15 million. As far as the governor's supplemental budget, we did ask for $25 million in federal receipt authority. We have $31 million in federal receipt authority. For bulk fuel, we've asked for additional $25 million because we have approximately $50 million coming from the Denali Commission to help projects in rural Alaska, but we want to make sure we have the federal receipt authority. Generally, the legislature has no issue with that. And then that, and the 31 and the 50, it gives us enough that if there's a little bit of movement in addition to the 50 million, because we don't know if we're going to get 55, 56, or 50, or what. So that gives us that room. And then there is the ask for a state match for the indirect cost, $650,000 for a reappropriation, to offset our set funding from the federal government. And then also we did recently receive, a grant, bulk fuel, high cost of energy. We put in for the grant. We got $2 million, and we received it. And after our trip to D.C. and meeting with the Department of Ag, they came forward and offered another $5 million. So we have to take receipt authority to take that money in again. So those are kind of the primers on the budget. As far as the operating budget is concerned, the governor's budget almost mirrors what we had asked for. The one thing that is different is we did ask for $650,000 for a building lease to move to a different building or to pay at our current location. The governor did remove that out of the budget. And then going forward, power cost equalization, and as the governor adjusted the amount required to fund the PCE through the statutory calculation. And that was one of the things, and I'll just bring this up, it's going to be an issue, I think, this particular legislative session. And that is the, what we have set aside by statute, which is a 5-year average on PCE, is about $44 million. The cost of the program is probably going to be more than $44 million. And so the legislature and the governor has to figure out what they want to do. We can do a pro rata share and just pay, and not pay the 100% and pay a 95% level or something along those lines, or they can put additional money in. Or for some reason we have a warm winter and the fuel oil prices are down and cost adjustments make up that difference. But the thing was, is the legislature several years ago, the program was 500 kilowatts, and the legislature raised that to 750 kilowatts that we would cover. They never increased the funding to make up that difference. So the program cost of $33 million went up now we're in the $45 to $50 million range with no additional funding and using the calculation of the 5-year average. So it's just one of those things that's kind of caught up with us. Either the program has to come up, we have to put additional money, or if we have a great year in the stock market. But again, that's put into a 5-month rolling average. So there's that issue. They did make the normal salary adjustments and Alaska healthcare adjustments for employees. Their management plan had asked for $70.5 million. The governor's budget is 68.8, and then we have our funding receipts of where that funding all comes from. So that's kind of a high level of the governor's budget, but there's nothing, like I said, for our budget being $68 million or operating. We can, like I said, a couple of those were wishes, like with the example of $650 for a building lease. But for the most part, we were held pretty good.
Mr. Chair, that answers my question. It was a very comprehensive run by the executive director. If there isn't any other questions, call for the question.
I have questions. This is Robert.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, through the chair, thank you so much. I do have a question on the cruise ship. You mentioned for funding cruise ship projects, is that $15.3 million earmarked, or is there an application process?
The $15.3 million is for electrification of cruise ship docks, so it's very specific to the electrification of it. And we have been asked to develop the criteria to be used for communities to apply for that funding. Is he there?
Robert, you're cutting in and out a little bit, so we're not hearing a response. We're still not hearing you, and we're showing you muted on our end. Well, no, we're showing you unmuted.
No, he's muted.
Now you're muted.
Can you hear us on the Teams meeting?
My apologies. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can. Yes, we can.
My camera just went down in microphone, but I'm trying to use the laptop, so I'm kind of bent over talking. I'm sorry. Curtis, I didn't hear anything you said. Everything kind of went down for me. I really apologize.
Not a problem. What the $15.3 million is for dock electrification for communities, and AEA has been asked to develop the criteria in which for communities to apply for that funding. And so just on a bigger thing, like, for example, AEA is already working with with Chugach and the cruise ships to do that dock electrification. Seward has money in a federal grant for dock electrification. So primarily this is looking at Juneau, Sitka, and Ketchikan, and possibly Skagway for adding dock electrification. But, of course, the two components is one, a public dock, and two, you have to have available power. So, but we've been asked to develop this criteria for this program, and I would anticipate that the funding would be ongoing until all the dock electrifications would be considered done for the cruise ships.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answered my question. May I follow up with a second question?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Looking at the operating budget, I see $1.4 million in there for the Renewable Energy Fund, but what I don't see is any money in the actual fund itself, understanding that the REFAC committee didn't meet until January, and so it is legislatively appropriated. However, if legislation doesn't appropriate any dollars this year, I guess what's the point of putting $1.4 million to operate a program with no money?
A couple of things is we are required by statute to give the legislature the list of the projects by the 10th day of a legislative session, which we have done. So we have met our statutory obligation. Also, it is not the responsibility of the governor to put it in his budget. The governor in the past has put money in the budget as a placeholder for the legislature to finally decide what amount they want to put into the budget. And so the governor, just overall, there was a lot of projects that he put no funding in that previously did because of the fiscal situation. But again, the legislature is the one ultimately the appropriators. As far as the $1.4 million, is currently we have over 100 active projects that we're managing from previous years. And so that $1.4 is to pay for the staff time and the staff to continue to operate the program of the 100 or so active REF projects that we have underway. And a normal window for a REF project is up to 5 years, or is up to 5 years. And so all that is doing is allowing us to continue to work on that REF projects that have been approved in the past.
Great answer, Curtis. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Okay, further discussion on the capital and operating budget or questions?
Hearing none. If none, I'll call for the question now.
Okay, roll call vote, please.
Okay, yes, sir. Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
Mr. Mathiasen?
Yes.
Mr. Seidman?
Yes.
Mr. Isso?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Mr. Copeland?
Yes.
The motion carries, Chair.
Okay, the next item under new business is Resolution 2026-02, amending the bylaws, Chair and Vice Chair serving two consecutive terms. Would entertain a motion.
Tony Izzo, I'll move that the Board approve Resolution 2026-02, amending the bylaws to permit Chair and Vice Chair to serve up to two consecutive terms.
This is Colwell, and I'll second.
Have a motion, a second. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I have one question.
Yes.
This is Robert. Does this require a supermajority?
They're looking at me, and I will pull.
We're looking at Mark.
I can check that. Oh, Mark. Do you know?
We're just checking. I think it's just a resolution like any other in simple majority, but Mark's checking on that.
The reason why I ask is typically amendment of bylaws requires a higher vote.
That's right. Thanks for the reminder. While we're waiting, did you have a question?
Thank you, Chair Copeland. Maybe just for context to confirm that currently these are one-year terms, two-year terms. Thank you. I just wanted to get that on the record that we're not looking to take a five-year term and make it into something where it can now be extended and turned into 10 years. It's 2 years is a very reasonable period of time. I think for the sake of continuity, I'm going to support the motion.
While we're waiting, I guess I'll comment as well, since it does involve the chair and vice chair. And I think, too, there's an element of continuity, especially, I think, looking ahead at a potential administrative change. Sometimes directors are new directors are appointed, so forth. I think having some continuity on the board, or at least a path to have that continuity, is a good thing. So I'll be supporting the motion as well.
Mr. Chair.
Tony, and then Robert.
Oh, and again, just a clarification, this doesn't change the election process or the timing of the election process at all.
That's correct.
So it's not a guarantee that the current term is going to be an extension. There's still the election process in the bylaws.
That's right. It doesn't require a two-year term. It just allows it. It is a term of 2 years. Yeah, it is a term of 2 years, but there is still an election process. Robert.
Yeah, is my speaker or microphone working now?
Yeah, you're coming in very loud and clear now. Thank you.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Yes, so I will support this as well. I think continuity is important, especially with an organization like AEA. I just wanted to make sure that we have the votes needed, and that was what my question was about.
Okay. Mark.
The bylaws do specifically address amendments to the bylaws, but they don't call for a supermajority. What they say is that the bylaws of the authority may be amended at a regular or special meeting, but no such amendment may be adopted at a special meeting unless all of the directors are present or at least 7 days written or electronic notice of the proposed amendment and if the meeting has been previously given to all the directors. Otherwise, that's all that it has to say as far as amending the bylaws. there are no other special conditions called for, or there are no special conditions called for. It's the typical manner of voting, which requires when quorum is in attendance, action may be taken and motions and resolutions adopted by the board of directors at a meeting by the affirmative vote of at least 5 directors, which the voting of all questions coming before the affirmative shall be by roll call, with yeas and nays under 1 minute.
Hey, Mark, did I hear that all board members have to be present for a bylaws?
If there is.
At a special meeting.
If it's a special meeting.
If it's a special meeting, okay.
On a special meeting.
Thank you. Thank you. Further discussion?
No, Mr. Chair, that cleared it up. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Hearing no further discussion and not seeing any hands raised online, roll call vote, please.
Yes, sir. Commissioner Sandy's absent. Mr. Mike?
Yes.
Mr. Mathiasen?
Yes.
Mr. Stephen?
Yes.
Mr. Izzo?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Mr. Copeland?
Yes.
The motion carries, Chair.
Thank you. Now we're at director comments. I'll turn it over to Mr. Thayer.
All right. Thank you.
And Robert, just as a check, can you hear on your end okay?
I can now. My speaker and microphone and camera reset, and so bad timing, I would say.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, as far as the budget is concerned, under your tab 8A, is currently the operating budget of actuals through 9/30/25 with projections, and we are updating payroll now for December, and so we'll have updated financials. But basically, what I wanted to make sure the board is aware of, keep them informed of, is where our management plan is for the budget, what our actuals have been, obligations, what our projected remaining is, and then our estimate going forward. And so far, our owned asset category, we anticipate by year end to be at 82% of our budget. Rural energy assistance, we expect to be at 57%. These could change as we have new personnel that have come on board. We have a new person in our circuit rider program, and so that will fluctuate. Power cost equalization, we're predicting to be 99% of what our target is. But again, fuel oil, cost of fuel oil, a few other things will change that dramatically, and we won't really have a handle on that. And that's one of the issues that we've shared with the legislature and the governor's office, is how close that we're going to be on that particular program, which is important in rural Alaska. And then for statewide projects, right now we're currently at 14%, but that is because we went through that process with Department of Energy, particularly over the Cook Inlet Power Link, and we had to put things on hold while we went through that process. Now we're back in play. Jim will come up and discuss it, but we're going forward in our next 2 years. Our spend capital is going to be about $30 million, so $60 million on SIPLink, so there will be offsetting costs. But either way, we're anticipating to be 83% of budget today with 3 months and 9 month projections. So I would imagine by the time we have the report again, we're going to be 50-50 in the year. So we're going to have a much better idea where we're going to land as far as our budget is concerned. Okay. And then moving on. This was put into the book, our financing AEA's large capital projects. We had the special meeting in which just about everybody on the board attended. So, and I talked with the one board member that wasn't able to attend. And so this was the slide deck from that. As far as the large capital projects that we're looking at funding, obviously it's the Dixon Diversion, the Cook Inlet Power Link. We do have cost estimates in there with the projects. The Dixon Diversion cost, I will just bring up, has risen. We believe it's somewhere close to $400 million. Part of that is a contingency built in, but one of the things that we are going to be discussing with utilities, and that is during the We're doing an amendment, but we're soon going to be doing a relicensing process, and what we've discovered is during the relicensing process, there's going to be additional work that they would prefer us to do on Bradley, more cement on the front, more boulders on the back, which is about a $21 million project. And so we're looking at doing it in conjunction. As long as we're mobilized to have everybody at Bradley, now's the time to do that $21 million worth of work. And so part of that cost is additional stuff that FERC's going to be asking us to do in 5 years. And so that's the direction right now that we're looking at, is to try to do all that work while we have people on site. It just doesn't make sense to demobilize and a year later come back and do stuff. And then the cooking the power link, the same as about the 413. So our funds are 142. And then also what we have on slide three is the construction cost timeline for Dixon and then also SIPLink. And so you kind of see this spend level go up. And when I said 30 million, we have, that's our share. The feds will kick in 30 million. So that takes us up in 2026 and 27 and then 28, 29. So we have funding through SIPLink through 27. That's in the bank. And right now we are, and so we're working right now on getting the funding for Dixon. Just a little bit overview on both of them, just for the public's sake. We have been looking at different opportunities currently in how to fund Bradley, the Bradley expansion. We are not, there's a lot of opportunity there in the sense there's federal loan programs, the Department of Energy, also through the Department of Ag that we qualify for, we're meeting with. Regularly, we have applications pending with them. In addition to that, we've met with CFAB, the bank that currently has our notes. We've also, with Bradley, went to the state bond bonding committee and have secured $342 million of tax-exempt bonds, which only Bradley qualifies. Thank you, Senator Stevens, for putting that in 30-odd years ago. And so there are a lot of opportunities that we have. A couple of us will be going to NASIO next week and meeting in Washington, D.C. And then also we're meeting with the Department of Treasury to look at what type of investment tax credits. And we're meeting with the Assistant Secretary of Treasury on that point. Mark has been working diligently on that, on the Treasury piece of it. And then with that, we will also be talking about the Cook Inlet Power Link. Our opportunities are not as great, or maybe we don't have as many doors to open, because we have $206 million of a federal grant. It doesn't qualify for tax credits. It doesn't qualify for funding through DOE, because DOE is at a discounted rate, and they've already given us $206 million in cash, or no, literally in cash, or their share of it. So some of those, but there are bonding opportunities, others. And so we're running these parallel but separate projects, because the funding stack could be very different for each project. And we hope to have an update. And actually, we will prepare for the board and share it, and that is who we've met with in D.C. and kind of a little bit about it, because we had preliminary meetings in December. Now we're next week we have, I don't know, 12, 14 meetings, including we're meeting with the balance of the three FERC commissioners plus technical folks. And so by the time this is done, we've met with all five commissioners in regards to the project to get that piece moving forward as far as the FERC licensing. And then our goal in a perfect world would be to have the board this summer start to consider what the capital stack looks like and possibly close by the end of the year on the funding for Bradley. And then we'll immediately be doing SIPLink after that.
Okay, great. Jennifer, I don't know if you can see if hands are up between.
I don't.
Okay, great. We've just checked periodically in case there's any questions. Thank you, Curtis.
All right. And I actually asked Jim to come up.
Jeff had a question.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Thank you, Curtis. Very informative. Can you illuminate what the timing is, if you know what the FERC licensing is? And are we trying to do this pre-licensing or part of licensing for the $21 million upgrades or repairs? Or is that more like a categorical exclusion underneath the current license where it may be more timely rather than going to the FERC re-license? Anyways, I was just asking if you had any information illuminate in that area. I was just curious.
Yeah, we know we're going to have to do the work for relicensing. And so we're just being proactively and aligning it with the work that we're currently doing with the amendment. As long as we have the equipment on site and everything, we want to get that work done. But that actually is for the relicensing piece of it, which I think is 2030, somewhere like 2032, 2035, somewhere in that.
6 years.
Yeah. And so it's just like by the time we're there, it's just time to do it. So that's what that cost is. But Jim, you might have a little bit.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. The Board of Consultants has got together to review the Dixon portion of the project. They reviewed the probable maximum flood. And Ryan is on the line if we have any technical questions. He's the expert. But they reviewed the probable maximum flood and said it's actually going to be more than what was originally calculated back in 1991. And that would have it could overspill the project by about 3 feet. So if we do nothing else, before we get a relicense, we're going to have to raise the dam at least 3 or 4 feet to take care of that probable maximum flood. So that's the component that has to be done. Now, during Dixon, we're looking at, and Ryan's held a couple of, convened a couple of meetings, both on the constructability project of Dixon and how high should we raise the dam. And, of course, the higher you go, the more benefits are because you can store more water, but there's a cost associated with that. So he's been working with the utilities and doing a lot of work. You know, should it be 7 feet? Should it be 16 feet? But as Curtis said, we're going to have to raise it 3 feet, 3 or 4 feet, regardless of whatever we do. So that's kind of how that all rolls together.
And I don't want to dive in the weeds, but I know that FERC is very persnickety about how you fit with all your articles and conditions with your current licensing schemes. And there's been a recent advent where they're more likely to do categorical exclusions with your current license. In other words, you don't have to wait for the relicensing. It's still kind of like there's also bills in Congress trying to speed up that permitting to do exactly like what you're saying is doing small modifications or components. So I'm just curious because you're right. The timing is, as Curtis said, if you're mobilizing, it saves a lot of money by putting everything all together while you got the manpower and the needs out there. So, but I also know we're dealing with FERC.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Project update?
Yeah.
Okay.
Robert.
Yeah, there was two hand raised, but I'll start. With regard to the PMF, is that a result of the Dixon diversion, or was that a current configuration?
Ryan has raised his hand, so how about we let him answer that? Ryan, please.
Yeah, thanks. So the PMF study is in progress, so these are just preliminary results, but the increase in PMF is due to miscalculation in the drainage area, essentially in the 1982 study. So we know it's going to be about 44% bigger than what Bradley was originally designed for, but none of that has been finalized yet. We don't know if FERC would require us to make modifications to the dam during relicensing or potentially earlier, but we anticipate that it's highly likely that FERC will require some sort of modification to the Bradley Dam to pass the updated PMF. But the PMF study is still ongoing at the moment.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if I may follow up.
Yes, please.
I see there's an earthen part and then there's a spillway part. Does the earthen part, is it tall enough to meet that criteria and the works would be on the spillway, or is this a complete full spread height raise?
To pass the new PMF, we would raise the embankment dam and keep the spillway configuration the same. That's kind of the bare minimum modifications that we'd have to make.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I'd like to let the record reflect that Commissioner Sandy joined us. And Commissioner, we're just early in the director's comments on the agenda. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much.
Tony.
Yeah, and Curtis or Ryan, anybody, do we, you know, I think about raising the dam, and my mind wants to immediately go to, you know, how much fuel is that, and how does that translate into, for the railroads anyway, natural gas offset. We've talked about 1.5 billion cubic feet with Dixon diversion. Has that number been adjusted based on this information?
That number, to my understanding, has not been adjusted, but Ryan, has that been part of the discussion?
The 1.5 billion cubic feet was calculated based on the anticipated Dixon inflows. So that's roughly the same. It changes a little bit year to year because our 10-year average varies each year. We get new inflow projections.
But Ryan, that also, you know, that is contemplating a 16-foot dam raise.
Correct. Yeah. So the 16-foot dam raise gets you about 60,000 acre feet, a little over 60,000 acre feet of storage. But it doesn't really affect the annual energy production that you'll get from Dixon. That's more based on your total inflows. The storage just provides more flexibility and a little bit more head pressure through the turbines, which equates to about 2% more energy on all Bradley water.
Yeah, thank you. And, of course, I think the linkage to ZipLink is, you know, is also obvious in the need for being able to use that power when it's the most efficient.
Robert? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Does Bradley Lake spill every year?
This is great. I can speak to that. The only time that it has spilled recently was during the Swan Lake fire, which was about 5 years ago when the Northern Utilities were cut off and just Homer was using it, and it spilled for just a few days. But again, that was a fire related and a transmission line being down. And if we were to do the upgrades with ZipLink, we would not have had any spill because we would have moved the power through a different route, but not a different process or a different route.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, if I may follow up, this raises an opportunity, I think. We've discussed this before with regard to investment tax credits. By raising the project 16 feet, we potentially could change out the turbines to address the efficiency and gain efficiency at the generator level. And that may be a 50% cost reduction through the ITC program from the Treasury. And I think we're considering that. Is that correct?
Adding a third third generator is what I...
Tax credits by changing out the turbines, you potentially could increase your outputs by a percentage great enough that you would still be eligible for ITCs. And yep. With a 16-foot dam raise, you know, obviously, as you change your head and your operating levels, you change your efficiencies on your turbines, and we potentially could get, 5 to 10% increase in efficiency by changing out turbines. And just correct me if I'm wrong, how old are those turbines currently?
30 years old.
89,
I think. Yeah, so they're not that old, and we have no plans on replacing the turbines. As far as investment tax credits, there's a couple different avenues to go down there where you don't have to replace the turbines. Some of it's on the efficiency, and there's also some language in which the Secretary of Treasury can make a determination. And so we're going down a path in our ask or our research and our conversations in D.C. is not changing out the turbines but getting the investment tax credit. And like I said, there is a path forward. We have checked it with an accounting firm. We have also contracted out with an engineering or a law firm, and so we're pretty confident that can be done.
Thank you.
Without swapping out turbines.
I don't see any further questions. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Jim Mendenhall, Director of Owned Assets, here to give a update on the owned assets. We sent out a memo, but I'll go over quickly. Cook Inlet Power Link, where we are is the environmental review and 2026 survey planning. Our Josie Hartley, who's in the room, has been working on overseeing that component of the work. We've given a task order to an engineering firm to do some of the environmental work, and we're coordinating that with HDR and Stantec to ensure that we can, you know, determine a route, reduce technical uncertainties for the cable suppliers, and get some OEM pricing and installation costs during this next year. So we plan to do some high-resolution geophysical surveys, some minor grab samples just for the seafloor conditions, and survey the corridor, and we'll be loading that information into our project. We already have the permits for the NEPA permits for that work. Stantec is also working closely with HVDC converter and cable suppliers. They're going out. Stantec is finalizing the specifications for what we need, and they will be going out for pricing. We had done that previously about a year ago to get some requests through some requests for information, very preliminary information previously. This is going to be a little more solid, or will be some firmer pricing, and we expect to enter into contracts to, engage the companies to buy those materials. System configuration, we've had a few meetings with Stantec, EPS, and some of the utilities just to talk about the constraints on both sides, what we're looking to do. Our plan is to eventually have the 200 megawatt transfer capability. Initially, it'll be 100 megawatts, and we looked at the northern terminus is over at Beluga. The southern terminal will probably be over in Soldotna. It makes better long-term sense for the rail belt system. Financial status, we've got the $64.2 million in state funds, and we're still looking as the report for the finance committee and then the quick financing update. We're still looking for that $142 million. And AEA, a couple weeks ago, submitted the budget for the budget period number 2, which is July 1, 2025 to June 30, 2027. It seems to be we've had favorable comments from the DOE on our budget. And, of course, we started that process back in May. Then we had DOE process review that took September, and then we got through process review, and then there was a government shutdown, and then there were holidays. But anyhow, happy to report we're fully back engaged with the DOE on the project. Bradley Lake expansion, design and licensing efforts are ongoing. The plan is in February 9th to submit the application for the Bradley Lake expansion. It's probably be ready next week, but during next week's meetings, there will be meetings with FERC, and, you know, we are not allowed to discuss anything that's under FERC review, so we decided to wait till after the meetings, then we'll submit the application. Ryan had convened two meetings. One was the dam raise. We talked about how high the dam raise should be, 16 feet or 7 feet. So he had a workshop there on the 22nd. And then on the 27th, he also met with all the utilities and had a constructability spending sequencing workshop. And they also talked about pursue a construction management general contractor delivery, and should that be for the tunneling, the dam raise, and to try and get some certainty on costs. So there'll be some updates coming on the results of that conversation. We talked a little bit about the Board of Consultants and the probable maximum flood. So I'll go through that. And we purchased a three-phase transformer, we've sent out the purchase order for that. It's about a 2-year lead time, costs about $500,000, and this will be used to power the tunnel boring machine. We're going to use Bradley powered rather than diesel. And we also, as Curtis noted, we're reviewing the cost estimate also with current pricing and then with the adjustment that may be that may be needed with the probable maximum flow of the dam raise to look at the new budget. I also want to point out that a couple of weeks ago, Ryan was approved by FERC as a designated dam safety engineer. So that's a good deal for AEA and a good deal for Bradley. Transmission upgrades, we're working on primarily the Soldotna to Sterling and the Sterling to Quartz Creek line. Those are, we've got the phase one is complete. Phase two is moving along of the SQ line. I think we're 90% of the design package is done, and it's scheduled to be bid out in 2026. Permitting is underway, and materials have been ordered. And phase three, which is the last 14 miles from the Western River to Quartz Creek substation, that's going to be constructed in the winter of 28-29, and they're doing geotechnical work on that right now and starting some of the permitting right-of-way issues. Soldotna to Sterling, that section's owned by Homer Electric. It was planned to be done now, but due to some budget and some steel issues, we postponed that project. It's going to be approximately $36 million, and we're working with the utilities to figure out to get that back in the schedule. And let's see, I don't know if Bill Price or Pat Dmitrovich with owned assets Pat's been overseeing the transmission work and really focused on the Soldotna, Sterling, Quartz Creek, and Bill has overseen the intertie and the rail belt transmission strategic plan. And, of course, he's been immersed in the RTO, the RRC, the IRP, and it's lucky we have an advocate there for AEA and the rest of the ratepayers on that group. So happy to answer any questions.
Are there any online? Okay, don't see any.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next item up is Connor. And what that is just the Renewable Energy Fund, Round 17, I think we know what happened there, but to discuss round 18 in which the board was emailed all the information that was submitted to the legislature regarding round 18. But if you want to touch base on the different programs, I appreciate it.
Yeah. So as Curtis stated, the round 17, we're just waiting on the final execution of one remaining grant there, and we're just negotiating some terms with the grantee. So it's definitely coming down the pipe here pretty soon. So it's not necessarily a delay on our end. They're just running through some things as well, funding on their side and trying to arrange that and make certain that they can commit to the match as was stated in the application. So we always try to hold them to that for purposes of fairness. For round 18, we held the RETEC meeting in early January. Some of you were present at that meeting. Decided that we recommend a total of 29 projects for a total of $41.1 million as part of the to be appropriated as capital budget for FY27. As previously stated in this meeting, there is no current placeholder in that budget, but as was also stated, that's not the government, that's not necessarily the governor's requirement. That the appropriation is clearly at the discretion of the legislature, and it can move as would follow throughout the session. Regarding the PPF program, we've had some fairly active participation in that as of late. Most notably being two loans that were given out in support of Western Alaska, the impacts there from Typhoon Halong, and some of the utilities were very proactive in reaching out to us and looking to use some of the loan proceeds to get the utility back in operating order or to conduct necessary repairs on the gen sets to ensure that those gen sets can continue operating under adverse conditions should they arise again. There are also two loans that were paid off. One of those being the loan that was extended, I believe it was back in 2013 for the Delta Wind project, which sells power to GVA under the QF pricing arrangement, and the city of ATCA, which is for the and apologies in advance for the mispronunciation, but I believe it's the Chinooseq Creek Hydro Facility, which was constructed several years ago. That loan, I believe, was from 2008. And so they sought to pay that off and have done so. So there's just a lot of follow-up on the closing out of those two loans, releasing our security interests as necessary, and so on. Right now, we've got 15 loans, so we got two paid off, but two came in, so the total, there's a no net change in the amount of loans that we have outstanding. 15, at present, there's a, as of December, I should say earlier this month, there's about $28.9 million in loans outstanding this time. The 401 and 1D, we have three preliminary project selections, which we forwarded on to the Department of Energy for our second solicitation as part of that program. We do, and to the, I should say that those, the status of those, as some of those are continuing to clear through the NEPA process as required under the program. So even though we as an authority can make selections as part of the program, it's still required that DEA review and approve those for eligibility under the program and make sure that they align with the intent of what the funding was set out to do. You know, we don't anticipate any problems in getting those through, although it can take some time. There's been some, you know, risks on the federal side, and so we've just encountered some more lag time when it comes to turning these things around. But we are in active communication with our federal project officer, so we don't anticipate there being any kind of material delay in that regard. although there may be some considerations for depending on how the phases come out with respect to one of the applicants that we've selected, them electing to do kind of a first phase and then helping that first phase design inform what the NEPA process may look like for then the phase that would come after. The funds would still be earmarked for the whole project. We would just kind of put in a contingency for kind of a go and no-go on that. And then if elected not proceed for some reason, those funds would then be made available for the third solicitation. It would be made available in addition to the funds that would come in for this third solicitation under the program, which means the space would be, I would say it's probably about $20 million. So we had 17.6 this last round, and there would be another 20 for a total of about 60 under the program in total. The Energy Efficiency Loan Program, this is something that we initially partnered with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation on to help bolster and to offer some interest rate buy-downs on their energy efficiency revolving loan program. There just wasn't a whole lot of uptake in that program, and it didn't necessarily align in terms of the how they'd be able to report on some of the metrics that were required and with respect to some of the audit requirements as part of the federal program that weren't required under AHSC's program as it stood originally. And so it was determined, and I should step back. As we know, the Alaska Sustainable Energy Corporation was created as a part of legislation last session, and that's being stood up. And so now that that's been formally incorporated as a subsidiary of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, although independent, although governed by the same board, that there's anticipation that there's going to be some federal funds that would come in to help bolster those programs. A lot of those, due to the change in administration and change in priorities on the federal side, were reappropriated for other purposes. But we felt that this was something that could help kind of, you know, get them to where they need to be, at least being able to implement some residential energy efficiency loan programs. And so that's what they sought to do with this money. So now the changes to that, the programmatic changes were approved by the on the federal side back in October. And then we just had a new MOA that was entered into with ASEC back in, I should say, about late November. And then we're just looking to execute some RSAs. But there's still definitely some details on ASEC side that they're still trying to iron out with respect to their selection of lending partners and making sure that, you know, that the whoever it is that they decide to ultimately work with to do perform some of that co-lending on the residential loan side would be in compliance with the federal requirements of the program and being able to stay on top of the auto requirements and other requirements. I think that's it.
This is just the
This is the
loan dashboard, which 15 loans, no delinquency.
Yeah.
I see if there's questions.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Any questions? Jeff?
Yeah. Connor, thank you very much. You're very busy with a lot of programs, and I appreciate your command over explaining to us at the high level. A question for you with the Renewable Energy Fund, Round 18. Historically, the legislature has gone in there at regional dynamics. They look at, hey, we're only going to fund $10 million. How far does that get us down the list? Or $5 million, how does it get down the list? Not to pinpoint you, but in the round 18, you have 34 projects, $54 million. If the legislature was to come in and give X, and I don't know if it's 5X or 1X or 10X, in the prioritization with your group that determines the priorities, are we talking like one big project right out in front, or is there a multiple number of projects for political purposes, regionalizing? I'm just trying to get an understanding of what the dynamic looks on the priorities out of that 34.
Yeah, that's a great question. So when we look at that, the historical practice is that there is no cherry picking of projects when it comes to monies being appropriated. So we can't say that, you know, if the legislature wants to put $10 million out, we can't pick the first project and then pick project number 3 and skip number 2.
Right.
But with respect to the consideration for kind of regional balancing of these opportunities, that is something that we strive for as a part of the program, and something that we do take into consideration when we do meet with the REFAC. Although it's somewhat nuanced in the sense that we can't necessarily force anyone to apply to the program, right? So there's clearly regions that we just don't receive many applications from, you know, North Sulphuro being kind of the primary example there because they do get cheap energy through other means. You know, there definitely is consideration for that, and I guess to your point, I mean, it really depends on kind of how, you know, who it is that's looking to put money into it, and so it generally requires kind of a coalition of a number of legislators in that regard. So if you're, you know, the rural folks want some projects funded that are, you know, at the top 10, you know, but there's some robot ones in there, then, you know, I'd imagine that there's going to have to be some cooperation between the two. But there's not, we do provide some degree of kind of apples to apples comparison. We can look at like the cumulative, you know, net benefit of the projects as we move down. And so that's something that we've appended. We've also received comments from a couple legislators about can we append, you know, what the necessarily fuel cost savings would be for those particular projects. So they have a better method by which they can determine, you know, what's kind of your best bang for your buck, especially considering the fiscal situation that we're in now. But the process for ranking the projects remains the same. That's something that's gone kind of unchanged throughout. I mean, it's fairly robust analysis. We do a lot of kind of a third-party and independent reviews of these projects, so it's not necessarily we as the authority don't have a bias. In that regard, we're not trying to push particular projects one over another. We're trying to just keep it very, very fair and balanced to the extent that we can. And if for some reason There's a feeling that one project should be moved up in the ranking, and other than we can confer again, and if that's the will, then that may happen. But that hasn't happened in the past. It's generally just presented as is. We say that, we present these in conjunction with the recommendations from the REFAC, and just kind of leave it at that.
Follow up. Yeah. Thank you very much. I think I'm thinking and I appreciate the integrity of the system. I think is stellar. I think it goes through a great process, and you want to depoliticize that. And yes, you got to look at all regions, but it's either a good project or it's not so good project, and that's where it falls down on the prioritization. I guess I'm looking at is, you have the current list. I don't know what the priorities are, but, is $5 million going to move the needle for 4 projects, 10 projects, or is there like a number 2 project that's $27 million out of the 43 that, it's a little harder for the legislature to get multiple projects? And I'm not saying that there's anything different with the priorities. The priorities are what they are. I'm just trying to get a grasp of what we're looking for, if 5 or 10 million will move the needle.
On that point, traditionally the legislature has funded complete projects.
Right.
So say we have 3 projects and it's $2 million apiece. They don't usually give us $5 million and have to cut the last one in half.
Right.
What they'll do is they'll prorate it. So for the most part, the legislature on their own has kind of decided that point and then drawn that line. And last year, the governor put in 6.2, the legislature accepted the 6.2, and that funded a certain number of projects and ended it there. So part of that historical practice, that doesn't mean the legislature doesn't do something different. But one thing is, and just to reiterate with Connor, the process that they go through, we have 4 legislators that sit on the REFAC. So that also provides some continuity and also gives some reassurance, I think, to the body itself, to the legislature, that how the decisions were made and how that line was drawn, so to speak, as far as labeling the projects. And the thing is just because they're number 30 on the list doesn't mean they're a viable project. It just means that they have, once it's scored higher, still means it's a good project, necessarily. If it wasn't a good project, it wouldn't be on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some where we went out in round 18, some round 17s reapplied in round 18, and they actually got moved up the list just because the project changed.
Sure. And Curtis touched on it, but there's the $4 million cap and a $2 million cap, so that tends to spread the number of projects that can get touched.
No, thank you. I'm feeling this through because we want to support the program, and this just gives us the board member situational awareness.
Yeah, I can follow up, but in our transmittal legislature, we provide a list of the projects. You can actually see, if you give $5 million, that gets you down to, project number 4. I mean, they it's pointed right out to the dollar. So just as much as what was funded from round 17, it's a very specific number, $6,600,000 and some additional funds, but that gets you exactly to number 6.
I think the Alaska Power Association, the legislative findings next week, and I'm sure this is going to be a high element of the discussion there, and I know AEA staff are going to be in that discussion. So, I saw your hand up. Did that answer your questions?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. I saw your hand up, Robert.
Yeah, thank you. On the 40101D program, do we anticipate a potential shutdown today or tomorrow to impact the timing on that?
To answer your question, no, not to our knowledge. In our discussions with our federal project officer, that was not something that was raised as a concern. That the funding is still yet available for the program. It's just a matter of timing. It's to determine when, in fact, that money's going to come out. I don't know to what extent this program remains a super high priority. The only reason that I state that is because there's already so many projects ongoing that are funded through this opportunity, so it's really just dependent on what the will of the federal administration is to continue to move on this and where it remains on their priority list. But the funding remains, and it's never been allayed to us availed to us that's a concern that the funding would ultimately go away.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may follow up. The only reason why I asked that is there was a program called 247, Section 247 for enhancing hydro, And that SEPA, for example, got a notice of award in 2024, I think, and here we're going on 2 years. So, and a lot of it has been due to the shutdowns and administrative changes and things like that. So I just wanted to get the feel in the room on the 401D. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and just to follow up, for this second round, it should be noted that AEA has the money in hand for these projects. That money's already been awarded, so there's no risk in terms of that money being, other than the sense that I suppose there's a very, very far and remote possibility that for some reason, if there's some, if the federal administration was so inclined, it could claw that back. Although I think there would be some, issues with that, with not only us, but numerous other states. But so I hope that helps to answer your question.
Yeah, thank you. You did great.
Yeah, thank you.
Right. Next up is the Renewable Energy Efficiency Program update by Audrey. I will just mention the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure, the NEVI program. I will ask Josie real quick just to come up and touch on that. Josie started with the program and developed the program, and then she got promoted up and moved into federal programs, but still has kept this in her portfolio. So if you want to just give us a brief update, I'll appreciate that. And we'll follow it up with Audrey with the rest of AHH.
Thank you, Curtis. Our EV program has been making strides in the last couple of months. We are continuing to host the outreach side of the program through our Alaska Electric Vehicle Working Group. Recently hosted a session to talk about the EV shipping policies, which was really well attended. There seems to be a lot of interest from the public on that topic, and we've really been working to keep the public informed on that through our newsletter. Our first funding source, a federal funding source, is through the Department of Energy. It's our Alaska Rural Electric Vehicle Deployment Project. We've selected two new sites for grant negotiations in Valdez and in Cordova. We have constructed new level 3 charging in Glen Allen recently, and that's commissioned and available for public use. And we are currently constructing new level 3 charging in Delta Junction to improve options for public charging there. We are also currently engaging with Tok, Bethel, Galena, Kotzebue, Sitka, and Skagway to receive grant funds. We're not sure which communities will want to move forward yet, but there's definitely interest in the program. On the NEVI side, we've been progressing since the program was suspended and then restarted under the Trump administration following the approval of our new NEVI plan by Federal Highways. We're continuing to work with our partner DOT and our federal partners to finalize our approach to right-of-way and Uniform Act compliance. One current event in Congress, the TFED bill this year, it actually will redirect about 10% of the unobligated NEVI formula funds, and then they will also redirect about 12% of the NEVI discretionary funds. So that's the CFI, or Charging and Fueling Infrastructure Program. So if that was applied proportionally across the states, that would represent about a $5 million decrease in our formula allocation, so from $52 million to about $47 million. We've been tracking, and it's not entirely clear how those redirections will play out, but we'll continue to monitor and just see how it goes. But, it was a very generous allocation to begin with. If it's reduced by 10%, it shouldn't impact the program too much moving forward. We've been in contact with our site hosts for the NEVI program that we had originally selected under our first solicitation. So we have 5 sites along the alternative fuel corridor between Anchorage and Fairbanks that we're still developing. They would still like to move forward with their original proposals. However, there have been some changes in the OEM market. So some OEMs have been adjusting their business model, and part of those adjustments include that they may no longer pursue Alaska as part of their reach and their portfolio. So we are planning to host, the EV Working Group is hosting a roundtable discussion with a number of OEMs on February 12th to talk through some of that and to get updates on what their business models are going to look like moving forward, and just generally their strategy as it relates to Alaska. That's about it for the EV update. I don't know if there's any questions.
Yeah, Tony. Yeah, thank you for that, Josie. If you could just clarify OEM, for me, that's original equipment manufacturers or vehicle manufacturers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're...
We're talking about OEMs for the EVSEs, so the charging infrastructure providers, so like a Flow or Tesla or something like that.
Yeah, thank you. I just needed that clarification.
Yeah.
Thank you, Robert.
We need to do better on acronyms.
Yeah.
Robert?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate you discussing that a group of experts met on the battery safety and shipping. That's a big concern, I think, in Alaska. I'll give an example. We bought an EV, got it shipped up here, and then we couldn't ship it back down to get it repaired. And so that's a big issue. My question, I guess, would be, is there potential to engage with Alaska Marine Highway Systems on potentially picking up that gap in shipping that we're seeing?
Yeah, and Des is raising his hand here. He's pretty plugged into that, no pun intended.
Des? Yeah, so Robert, I'll answer your question and then also want to ask Josie a question. On February 11th, there's going to be a panel discussion with AML and Craig Torunda with AMHS, and it's an EV transportation solutions panel. They've been invited. I'll moderate it, but our whole scheme is to not point fingers. There's safety issues. There's other things to try to come up with solutions. Do we have silver bullet solutions? The answer is no. I think it's going to be a process, and I encourage, you know, AEA to help sponsor it or help just be a participant so that we can get it out to other people and film it and or Zoom it so that other people outside of Juneau. Just so you know, Robert, your representative from Ketchikan will be sitting on that panel, Jeremy Bynum as well. So it's policy and trying to figure that out. So it is important, obviously, to your vehicle to ship back, but there's another 1,200 vehicle owners in Southeast Alaska that are in the same boat, and I do not think the issue is going to go away. Specifically talking to Craig Torunda, he has explained to me, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want everything attributable to him, but he says there is indeed safety concerns. They have to do fire training and other things, and so there's real world issues with them. So I would just say stay tuned. But yes, I think Josie's doing a great job of having the workshops and doing the newsletters, but there's also a lot of public support to keep moving on this.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I may follow up.
Go ahead, Robert.
And where this leads me to is battery energy storage systems. My understanding is they are treated separately and apart from EVs. With that being said, they have standards of shipping and how they quarantine or address them in safe areas. And I guess when we do meet here on February 11th, I think that conversation needs to be brought up because that is also potentially the next step is to ban BESS systems. And if it is, we should probably get ahead of that. But if it isn't, then we may be able to discuss how EVs and BESSs can be shipped in the same manner.
And if I may.
Yeah,
I'm smiling. You can't see my face unless you see it on there. But, yeah, my particular company has a 10-megawatt, 20-megawatt-hour battery energy storage system. So we're front and center on the issue and looking to get it resolved. So, Robert, yes, the other thing is Home Depot, every battery energy tool uses lithium of some type. And so there's also remote cabins in Alaska that have their own solar and they need the lithium battery backup. So it's a bigger issue and you're right. You know, where does it stop with EVs and then where does it go with other lithium battery chemistry issues? So, Josie, I just wanted to move on to the question for you. When I was talking to Mr. Taranga, he said that underneath his guidelines for shipping on ferries, they like to have a sweet spot of 20% to 70% charge in the battery when it's being shipped. When it's overcharged, it goes out of that safe zone. I said, well, I was asking him, I said, well, you know, we'd like to get chargers in the NEVI program eventually to every battery, every ferry terminal for these battery vehicles. And he said that would be so helpful, or would be helpful in the sense that the ferry employee could go out and check your battery energy storage that you're within the safe limit for shipping, which then addresses their concerns with safety, but also can address the public's concerns of being able to ship. But secondly, then you're not running to the ferry terminal making sure your battery's filled up because you now only have a 20% charge when you get off, and that would allow the passenger vehicle to be charged after it gets out of the port, so then it could continue on with its driving. So I just wanted to share that because I know in the NEVI program, eventually, Cordova and all the other places, everywhere the ferry terminals are, is that we're going to get a potential charging system.
Yeah, that's correct. So we're really still operating under phase one of the program, which is building out the alternative fuel corridor between Anchorage and Fairbanks. Once we have our designation as fully built out, which is a bit easier to get under this administration than it was previously, then we'll move on to phase two, which is basically everything else. So remainder of the highways and the marine highway system. But I hear your point that I think that would be something good to communicate to DOT and federal highways as well, because it then does become a safety thing as well, you know, to be able to monitor the state of charge of the vehicles that are boarding the vessel. So that's a great point, and I'll pass that along.
Cool. Okay, thank you, and thanks for the questions and discussion. I do want to try to keep us moving along through the report, so we have want to make sure we have adequate time for strategic planning. And Duff, if you have those meeting times and dates, you can circulate to the board and maybe copy in Josie and stuff, that would be of interest. Thank you.
Will do, Mr. Chair.
Curtis?
Audrey, for the rest of the
board.
Thank you. Audrey, I'll shoot with our AAA. We'll set up on the where Josie left out, moving on to the hydro, the small hydro section. Essentially, working with our DOE Energy Fellow, we conducted a small survey of small hydro utilities around the state to try to determine whether they're selling renewable energy credits or RECs. Essentially, we didn't get much of a response. I believe of the 14 utilities that we were unsure whether they're selling RECs or not, we got responses from four, and of those four, they're not selling RECs. Speaking to the 5 Mile Hydro Project, that's an AEA-managed hydro grant, receives funding through not only AEA's REF, but a DOE grant, Denali Commission. Chittenden Electric receives the DOE grant directly for the project, so it's a kind of a partnership project. We're moving forward with procurement activities, essentially going to be putting out a procurement to conduct clearing of the project site and then purchasing long lead items, hoping to start construction soon, essentially pending, of course, NEPA approval, which we're hoping will come quickly. On the energy efficiency and state energy program side, one thing to note, want to talk about is using our SEPBIL funds, grant funds. We released a request for applications for LEVI for the Renewable Energy Efficiency Program. Well, projects, this is a little bit more flexible in that it's open to more potential subawardees, grantees. We set aside $1 million of SEPBIL funds for LEVI, so we released a request for applications. Gotten quite a bit of response for that RFA already, applications to end of the month. On the EECB's side, those funded LEVI projects, they're moving along. We
Whittier was our first project to the finish line. They finished their energy efficiency project last month, and we were able to do a site visit to kind of close that one up. On the homes rebate sides, essentially no new updates from the last board meeting. DOE is still reviewing updated guidance. That update has been ongoing for well over a year. This is one where we received early admin funds, and then essentially we had to submit another application to remove conditions on the original award. Let's see. We did submit a letter of support to DOE requesting rollout of these programs, but in light of that, the team has been making some progress with what we can, develop the foundation for an online rebate application, and then, of course, an admin portal, and drafting some required, like the consumer protection and market transformation plans. One thing to note is if it doesn't progress forward soon, we're getting low on our early admin funds, we will have to think about shelving until new DOE guidance, or DOE provides the new guidance, is available and removes conditions on the awards. TREC, or Trading Residential Energy Contractors, that's moving along. Updates on your packet. On the biomass front, the team is planning for a wood conference later this spring with using one of our U.S. Forest Service grants. Moving forward on our design for the four communities. And then one thing to note on the community wood grant, this is for the redesign of the Tok Combined Heat and Power Project. Of course, Tok is, we did receive a Denali Commission award to help provide the state match portions of the funds. So we're working through that grant award process right now. Kind of following up on the board update from last meeting for Solar for All, that's right, last meeting essentially gave the update that the EPA had terminated that program nationwide. We did complete the closeout process for that last month, and that's my update.
All right, thank you. I'd like to invite Tim up to help. It's Chris McConnell, but Tim is responsible for rural programs with just a brief update.
And I will keep it brief. As everyone knows, significant winter storms impacted most of western Alaska, specifically Napaskiak and Akiak, suffered extensive damage to their distribution systems. Fortunately, both the federal government stepped in with a $25 million emergency declaration, and the state did as well. DOT headed up the effort of repairing most of that distribution system, effort that's still ongoing. Notably, for the first time in 20 years, the Alaska Bulk Fuel Infrastructure Project has put $100 million into bulk fuel in rural Alaska. This came from the Denali Commission. It was successful in getting the money. ANTHC, because it couldn't be directly given to the state, it had to go through an intermediary. So ANTHC awarded $50 million to AEA and $50 million to AVEC, and the communities are named there for you to review after that. There's indications that there may be two more tranches of $100 million in the coming years, which would go a long ways to impacting the over $1 billion of deferred maintenance that exists in rural Alaska. The circuit rider program, although not mentioned here, we were fortunate enough to get a highly qualified diesel mechanic hired on in our fourth position, which we go a long ways towards mitigating future emergencies and the level of service we can provide in rural Alaska. DCE, this is the funding levels, and as you can see, it's just recently kind of got back up over $1 billion, but what I'd like to touch on mostly has been mentioned earlier is we're projecting a shortfall between the level of funding and the amount of money to make full PCE payments, which may require being prorated, in which case if we had 95% of the funding, we would just pay 95% of whatever the applicant did for their PCE program. We'll see what the legislature does with that. The program is ready to respond to that in any case. I think mine is short.
Yes.
Questions?
Jeff? I got one quick question. We already heard from the executive director on the shortage of the PCE and the 95% and whatnot. Do we have a projection going out 1, 2, 3 years for long-term planning as far as where that fund is headed with the 750K versus if this trend continues? And what I'm trying to do is, you know, we may have to modify programs or just live with cuts, but I'm just trying to get a, you know, not what here's at our feet right now where we're trying to deal with the here and now, but what is it 1, 2, 3 years forward?
We only have eyes on the horizons for 27, to be very frank. Mm-hmm. Past that is too much of a guess.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. I'm just, for legislative planning and whatever, if there was any trend lines, I'm just, I hear you, though. It's kind of spooky as far as trying to extrapolate.
It is.
Mm-hmm. It was spooky when they increased the budget, the kilowatts by 50% and no funding.
We're going to get, well
everybody the rule is, hey, this is great.
That's right.
Just to follow up, I think, and certainly agree with Tim, it's hard to, you know, see beyond a year or two, but there are clearly going to be some significant data points filed in the coming months. I know one in particular with a one-year extension on the Hillcorp contract that my company filed starts to give line of sight to the increase in cost of Cook Inlet gas. We're not at the point where we're going to see what LNG import costs are yet, but I think we will in, you know, the next 12 to 24 months, and that's going to be a significant impact on top of any shortfall. So it's more of a commentary. I know you're aware of it, but it would be really interesting as those data points come, start plugging that in so we can see what that gap starts to look like.
Yeah, we'll be watching closely what the base rate is in that calculation, what happens on the rail belt impact for Alaska as well.
Yep. If that $44 million, if the floor rises, it shrinks that, but if fuel prices rise, it raises it. That's just so hard to look out past.
That's exactly.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Karen. Karen, as you know, she runs our rail belt transmission organization, or is the manager of it. And of course, some of the questions you might have are, we have a pending docket with the RCA. But Karen.
Thank you. Good morning. The rail belt transmission organization submitted its open access transmission tariff to the Regulatory Commission on July 1st. That is the pending matter that Curtis just spoke about. We have submitted reply testimony in that matter, and we've also replied to two orders that were put out by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska regarding the Alaska Intertie Agreement. And we have a hearing that's scheduled to begin on February 17th. It's scheduled for approximately 3 weeks, so it's February 17th until March 6th. The final order in that matter is due on June 4th. Are there any questions?
Tony.
Karen, you do a great job in this area as a rail belt manager. I want to express my appreciation for AEA and your leadership. I think it's worth mentioning, and this is just my own opinion, you mentioned a couple of orders recently. One of them specifically, order number 9 in this proceeding, advised that the utilities were going to have to terminate a grandfathered agreement that provides for capacity. Specifically, my utility needs that agreement to ensure we can honor our CPCN to actually serve members off of this segment of, we're talking about the Northern Intertie. And the commission issued this order saying, we just want you to know that before the hearing, before all the evidence is in, that we're going to order you to terminate a contractual agreement. And we're going to give you so many years to do so. I think it's worth mentioning, first of all, in my experience, it's probably in the top 5 off-the-wall things I've seen regulatory commissions do in terms of legislating from the bench or expanding the scope. This one sends a chill, I think. If it were to, if what they're saying they're going to do, they actually do, I don't know who would enter into a contract that requires regulatory approval anymore. Grandfathered agreements in the lower 48 when RTOs have been formed have always been honored, and then over time, when the system warrants it, those agreements can be unbundled or terminated based on the users. As a participant in that particular agreement that depends on it, if we're forced to terminate an agreement, it sets a precedent that any agreement approved by the regulatory commission, they could just change their mind later and say, sorry, we're going to terminate it. I don't believe the legislation anticipated it, but it's just a very alarming recent event that I thought was worth maybe expressing, providing a little bit more color as an actual participant in that grandfathered agreement.
Thank you. And I would also just like to add that the Alaska Energy Authority did respond to Order 9. We did file comments specifically talking about AEA's exemption to RCA jurisdiction and how if those provisions were to become decisions, how that would impact the Alaska Energy Authority. And it would have some negative impact. So it was a response also from AEA.
Yeah, absolutely, and it was very well done. Again, thank you. I think you do a great job in this area.
Thank you. Other questions for Curtis?
Just on the point that Tony and Karen both raised, in Order 9 in particular, is because we have the Intertie Agreement. It's been in place 30-plus years. It works, and we do it by committee. So we rely on the utilities to chair that committee, to be part of that and help guidance. And when we had a boulder come down and almost knock out one of the towers, which would have been a cascading effect with other towers, you know, quickly assembled, Golden Valley, the utilities went in there and paid for that repair. But by what the RCA is contemplating doing, that puts that relationship at risk, where we're going to have to hire staff. And we're going to have a different budget mechanism to help respond to that 170-mile segment of that we currently operate just fine. And so that's a concern, I think, going in. And I wanted to put it on the record here that not only is the RCA saying, you know, we can get out of these agreements, but also the fact is we're going to put additional costs on the ratepayers through AEA, through the legislature, for requiring to pay for some of these costs that you already have an arrangement with the utilities of how to do it. Mm-hmm. Because it's much easier to use the engineers that the utilities have on staff to help manage and operate that than for us to go out and hire the staff to do that, to do something that we already get because of our arrangement. So, like I said, it is a concern in a couple different ways, and I don't know if they fully kind of thought that out, but we did raise that issue in our response.
Well, yeah, that certainly runs counter to the AEA's mission to reduce energy costs to ratepayers, and I think the RCA's.
Again, just for the record, there's open access on this line for others. It's not a matter of trying to keep something within the control of the utility. It's really an indication of the fragile system that we have, and I'm not trying to compare it to rural Alaska. But the rail belt is pretty fragile when you compare it to, a first world country like in the lower 48, system there, the redundancy, it's under FERC jurisdiction. We're not. And so these agreements, just like the Bradley agreements, are no different in terms of the scope. The commission could have said the same thing. Thankfully, they didn't. But these agreements are in place because of limitations on capacity. If there was a second line, I'd be the first in line to say, we don't need that agreement anymore. Who cares? Because capacity and the ability to serve on our CPCN and provide power to, thousands of members, it gets put at risk if the agreement goes away. It's an undersized line. We need to have that priority capacity, and then everything else can be open to the market. The problem is you've got a commission saying, before we even hear the evidence, we're going to adjudicate, and you're either guilty or you're not. It's just not the way the system should work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I will take up the next one with IT. There's a from our chief information officer that we do share with ADA. It's just a short memo. One of the things that we have been very aggressive, thanks to Leonard and our IT department, is moving into the 21st century. And so one of the things that is that if one of those items is updating our phone system. The last time we had an issue with our phone system, we had to buy a part on eBay, literally. So that kind of gave us an indication that we needed new phones. So not only are we going into purchasing new phones for the office, but we'll also be changing our phone numbers because we're commingled with ADA right now and even share the same main number. And so we're going to have different new phones with Zoom, and this will help for people working remotely that they'll be able to access, obviously, off their phone and not have to do the cell phone stipend. And then also with SharePoint OneDrive migration, we're trying to more of a migration to SharePoint and OneDrive to improve the accessibility, searchability, and for data security. We've kind of had stuff piecemealed all over the place, and so it's taken a lot of time on staff, especially Pam and the finance department, to kind of go back, pull that, make sure that we're archiving what we need to do, but keep the current information that we have. You know, I'll say some of our architecture was dependent on how they save things. There wasn't a consistency on filing or saving, you know, Joe's file. Who's Joe? You know, and so some of those issues are being resolved. Adobe Enterprise Migration, we're actually in the process of that. For a single sign-on, that was the other thing. We had to have passwords for everything that we did. Now we're moving to the single sign. And then Sylogist upgrade, and this is our finance and accounting platform. And this is in conjunction with ADA. We've shared a platform in the past. What we're going to do is have two separate companies. So we'll have our version, they will have theirs, and we won't be commingled. And so that has taken a lot of work, especially with financing and making sure that we have the historical data in the new system and along with training. And then also we, over time, had customized reports to the point where the people that needed the customization or wanted them are no longer here. And so we're going to be using more of it, shall we say, out of the box or off the shelf. And not doing as many customization, which just increased costs in the long term. So that's kind of a highlight of IT. The next item, and we have shared this with the board, a little different format, and that is we kind of keep what we call the federal funding tracker, and this just tracks everything that we have for our federal grant, from the status of it, you know, the source of those funds, the program, what the award is, required match, and required match percentage versus what that happens to be, and remaining match that is needed. So when you look through this, the total, say we have $534 million in federal grants that we're tracking, but actually the match component of that is $148 million, and SIPLink being $142 of that. So it helps us keep an eye on the ball of what we need. And then working with the legislature if there is match required. But it's several pages long, but these are active awards that we are managing. When you get back towards the back of it, there's some in different colors. There's a couple of conditional awards. The conditional awards that Audrey had mentioned, the $37 million. Actually, the high efficiency cost grant for KIPNUC, $3 million, we'll be moving that grant into awarded position, and then we have some pending review, and then there in red, just some applications where the program has been suspended or terminated of where we were at, where some of these grants that we had received or were looking at, so we can kind of keep an eye on those. So when you look at everything that we had going on, there's only been four that's been canceled or suspended. So it's a pretty good overall, but we'll keep this in your board packets and updated on a regular basis. And there is a longer version of this if you wish to see it with notes and other information, but this is just to give the board and the public a snapshot of all of our federal funding. And next on it, and this is just, we have statutory deadlines to do reports, and so this was in the report when the board packet was done. I do CC you as the board when we send these to the legislature, just so you know what was set out. We've already done our capital reserve fund shortfall. We have to do a Susitna River project annual report. That has already been completed. The renewable energy fund recommendations, which is due on the 29th. We actually sent that out on Wednesday, so we sent it early to the legislature. So that one says pending. That one has been completed. Revised estimate of need for withdrawal from the capital reserve fund. That says pending. That actually has been sent in. You've received a copy. What we are waiting outstanding, and then we have the project status report, which we've completed and is currently in the governor's office for review. That is due on the 3rd, and we will have that out before that date. And then we do have an annual report, which is due the first part of March. And then we have the PCE annual report, which is also the 1st of March. Those last two are not statutorily required, but we have discovered they are hugely beneficial for us in Juneau, that we have both of those available in a timely fashion. So we are on track for everything, and I do want to do a thing for Brandy, because Brandy, especially when it comes down to our annual report, that falls on her pretty heavy to get that done. I know that Clay has already been in correspondence with her back in December on the letter. And then also in your board packet, just so you have it, you do have round 18 here that we had discussed earlier and the metrics that was presented. And then the next item on the board packet obviously is the community outreach. Community outreach that we have done, so you can kind of keep track. And it is getting to the busier season, as especially down in Juneau. So we'll be down there a little bit more. Then the last and but not least for your board packet is just the articles of interest. If they mention AEA, then you usually get them emailed to you the day it comes out or the next day. But we do keep a running tally of just articles of interest for the board. So with that, I know it's 10:45, and we have strategic planning next. But I guess, is there any questions for the director's report? Or of staff?
Any questions across all the reports?
I would just like a question of interest. I saw, and I was curious if you received any reply. We didn't really cover it, but the Watana Susitna letter that you sent to our speaker and then our president. Any feedback?
No. And I'll be honest with you, on that letter, it is pretty much a generic letter that we send year after year, because it really depends on what is actually happening. And there's been, there's always people interested, and we always have conversations with people and answering inquiries to it, but there's not been a hard dollar amount put forward, so to speak, on that effort, which I think would trigger interest from other people in the community.
But hold that thought for strategic planning purposes. yes, LOL.
A quick request that I'd take you up. I don't know what time I'll have available to read a more detailed tracker, but if you'd send me the more detailed tracker, would be great.
Does that have a bottom line, like a totals across the bottom?
Yeah, this one we have a total across the top.
Okay.
We have a total across the
top. Okay, I missed that. I looked for it.
Yeah, it's kind of in an awkward spot. But.
Okay, thank you. I don't see other questions. Board, as we contemplate, we can discuss the next regularly scheduled meeting, I guess, but in April. Any items there?
The next scheduled meeting, I believe, is going to be April 16th.
That's okay.
It's currently on the schedule.
So we've been at it for hour 45 minutes. Do we want to take a 10-15 minute break before we go? We can go into executive session and take a recess, but...
How are you going to do it?
Okay. I'll entertain a motion to go into executive session.
You're not.
I'll make that motion, Duff Mitchell.
There's a specific one.
I'm sorry. I was trying to be helpful, but not following the right protocol. I move that, this is Duff Mitchell, Vice Chair. I move that the board enter an executive session to discuss confidential information related to the AEA strategic planning. This is supported by the Open Meetings Act, AS 44.62.310, which allows a board to consider confidential matters in executive session. In this case, the board believes that there are subjects which would have an adverse effect on the finances of AEA or are protected by law to rules protecting personal privacy and certain business information and deliberative process.
Tony Izzo, second.
Have a motion, a second. Discussion? Roll call vote, please.
Yes, sir. Commissioner Sandy?
Yes.
Mr. Smyth?
Yes.
Mr. Mathiasen?
Yes.
Mr. Seidman?
Yes.
Mr. Izzo?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Mr. Copeland?
Yes.
The motion carries, Chair. We will go into executive session.
And I invite the board has not taken any formal action on the matters discussed while in executive session. And we have board comments, and I will start online with Robert.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Great meeting today. I wish I would have been there with everyone. I do plan on coming in April, so you guys get to see my ugly mug in Anchorage. Great talk today. Great action that we took earlier in regular session, and great discussion in executive session. I'm excited with the future. I'm excited with the staff and the leadership here at AEA.
Thank you. I think we lost Ingemar just a few minutes ago.
Yes.
Okay. So, Tony.
I'll just echo Robert's comments. Thank you.
Luella?
Yeah, same support. Really appreciate the staff. It's clear you guys have a passion for what you do and something that we're going to need for 10 years to come. So,
done.
I have nothing more to say. Thank you. It's a good job today. It's just a good use of my time. And I think, like I said, I already learned a bunch. And I guess I feel proud for working.
That's a good way to put it. I feel like it's a good use of my time. Feel as a board member like I'm doing work that's important for the state. And I'm proud to be a part of the Alliance Charity Board. It's a great staff doing a lot of really important work for the state. Joy to work with Curtis. And, so thank you. One more motion.
Move to adjourn.
Second.
If there is no objection, I'm pausing. We're adjourned.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you, Robert.
Have a good weekend.
Yeah.